Welcome to Lives, a show exploring our experiences in the world and how we might live well. I'm Stuart Chittenden, and my guest today is actor, writer, and secular chaplain Elizabeth Morton. With Mass as her earliest performative expression, Morton talks about her twin vocations of acting and chaplaincy, and their similar characteristics such as curiosity, deep listening, and personal surrender. Morton shares what people are seeking from her ministry and spiritual direction, and how her non-dogmatic chaplaincy supports others in their spiritual seeking.
I couldn't not be an actor, because that's like me saying I'm not a woman, I'm not American. It's like part of who I am. And so I couldn't deny that. So I just said, okay, I'll just do it my way. I'll be an actor and this and this.
Elizabeth Morton is an actor, writer, and secular chaplain. Alongside her creative endeavors, Morton completed a two-year training in both interfaith ministry and spiritual direction. She's officiated dozens of weddings, memorial services, and various other ceremonies honoring life's transitions. But it's in those one-on-one conversations regarding an individual's unique path that she feels her chaplaincy is most purposeful. Morton is from Louisville, Kentucky, and has long considered New York City to be her home base. Today's show was recorded remotely. Elizabeth Morton, welcome to Lives.
Thank you. It's so good to be here.
So you were raised in Louisville, Kentucky. What stands out to you from your childhood?
I had a good childhood. I'm the oldest of four kids, and I went to Catholic school. So that was obviously very impressionable for me. But I was raised in the sort of social justice wing of the Catholic tradition. So some of the nuns and priests I knew were, you know, very much activists. My parents took us on a trip to Nicaragua when I was a child, and to a very poor town in Mexico. I was a social justice warrior as a kid. I went to my first March on Washington when I was 11. I just loved learning about social justice history. I had a book about Martin Luther King when I was about 6 years old that I read over and over again. So that had a big impact on me.
I think it's really interesting that quite often it's the role of kids to try to defy their parents, and so the cycle continues. It seems interesting to me that you were bitten by that value system. I was going to say bug, but that value system sort of caught you. And I wonder if you ever had a moment where you wanted to actually be maybe more mischievous and self-centered.
I didn't do a lot of rebelling against my parents. They gave me a lot of autonomy. They trusted me. And I think they trusted me to sort of understand my own inner compass. Even starting when I was about 10 or 11 years old, I would say, I need to take a day off school. And they would let me. It was a very good grades. And it was, you know, they kind of trusted me to know what my needs were in the world, which is pretty remarkable, actually. I have a joke about that. Well, a little bit. My dad actually was a celibate monk in the 60s. And so he obviously gave up that lifestyle. But I think there was something about him that is always was always still surprised that he was a father. And so he had no particular agenda for us. He was just sort of amazed that we even were.
Were you as siblings all quite similar? Or do you stand out to your brothers and sisters?
I mean, we're similar in that we get along well and we're friends, but we are all very unique. I definitely, out of the four of us, I think I have the most passion about social justice issues and politics and spirituality, for sure. So I definitely have that unique journey in terms of my sibs.
How did faith show up in your family context?
Well, it It gave me a relationship with my grandmothers. I was very close with both of them, and they were both very Catholic. And so I think it was just a shared language, you know? And I was raised, you know, I got baptized when I was 20 days old. I went through First Communion and Confirmation. But again, because my dad had had this sort of unusual history, and then also because we were so focused on the social justice element, I was allowed to ask questions. You know, my parents weren't so strict. I was allowed to say when I was 7 or 8 years old, you know, this whole thing about hell, that doesn't make sense to me. I don't buy it. And they said, okay. You know, again, I was given this, I don't know, permission or this encouragement to use my own mind, which is wonderful that my parents provided that for me. But going to Catholic church and Catholic school, I enjoyed the ritual of the Mass. I participated in that, which was something we did once a week with the family, but then we also had to go to church, you know, during the school year, during the school day, once a week. And I remember in first grade, you know, the priest coming in and saying, you know, who would like to read in Mass today? And my hand just, I couldn't raise it fast enough, you know. So I think I stood on a chair to be at the podium and the microphone, you know. So I always loved that element. And I suppose that is performance in a way, right? That the Mass is certainly theatrical. And I loved the ritual and the lighting of the candle and the bringing up of the gifts of the, you know. I loved the pageantry of it. And I was always really jealous that I couldn't be an altar boy, because when I was a kid, there were only altar boys, not altar girls. So these jerks from the playground got to be up there with the priest, and I didn't get to be. So I had to, you know, go read in Mass in order to participate.
So when you look back to your earlier life, is it in those areas or other areas where you see these first inklings that the stage or in front of a camera, some form of acting is, that was a future that you could see for yourself?
Yeah, I don't know if it was a future I could see for myself, but I definitely always had comfort. I always felt comfortable doing public speaking. That was never a fear that I had. I just would walk right up and talk and speak my mind or read something. And I remember having my first line in a school play, which was in the church. I was a butterfly. I had one line, and it was the Christmas pageant. And I said, "Hey, butterflies, we're going to see God's son." I have no idea why butterflies were in the New Testament story. But anyway, I remember just loving it. And I loved having the costume on and everything. And so I would participate in these school plays and things like that. And then one of my very best friends, her mother ushered at the Actors Theater of Louisville, which is a wonderful professional theater in Louisville. And so I went to go see a few professional plays when I was a kid. And that made a huge impression. And then we would go on field trips to the professional children's theater downtown. And I remember, you know, I was putting two and two together. You know, I was like, wait, this is their job. These people, that's their job. What? And so when I was 13, I told my dad, I said, I think I want to take an acting class. The next day, this is before the internet, you couldn't find everything instantaneously, and he found this wonderful 4-week training program called the Young Actors Institute. And I was in seventh grade, I was 13, and it was during the summer, 4 weeks, and I went to that, and I just was immediately at home. I just felt at home. So something clicked for sure.
How did you take it forward from there then? It sounds as if you weren't entirely clear that this was a career, but certainly you could be trained. And so it sounds as if there was this, almost this flourishing of your awareness into this possibility.
There was, absolutely. And I think it was at the Young Actors Institute for those 4 weeks where, you know, I was having teachers that had devoted their lives to this work and who had wonderful professional experiences and who saw something in me. And so I felt witnessed in that, which was wonderful. And the Young Actors Institute was held at the Performing Arts High School. So you know, I thought, oh, I got to go there. So I had one more year of Catholic school in eighth grade after my first acting class. And then I went to the Performing Arts High School. So I was only 14 when I entered YPAS, as it's called, YPAS, Youth Performing Arts School. And it was incredible. So out of my 4 years of high school, I had two classes a day that were theater classes, all 4 years. And so I had a headshot and resume when I was 14, and I was auditioning for plays in Louisville outside of school as well, and I was a very serious, devoted actor, that young, which is pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And probably in that context, too, you weren't being told this, but I wonder if one rung out, as it were, others were saying, acting, like, it's just a lesson in failure. This is not a career to plan for your life. Do something serious. I wonder if you had naysayers around you.
Well, it's interesting. Again, my parents were always very trusting of my inner compass, which I will always be grateful for. So they were supportive, 100%. And one of my grandmothers also was so enthusiastic about it. One of my grandmothers who lived in North Dakota, and she didn't know theater at all. I mean, that was not in any way in her reality. And she was not as enthusiastic, you know. I mean, she was supportive of me because she loved me. But, you know, I was a very good math student. And so I think she thought I would go more into that world. And I promised her I was going to keep up with my really, you know, my math classes when I was in high school. And I did. It's funny, I actually took advanced calculus as an elective my senior year of high school, which all my acting friends thought was nuts, but anyway. And so I did get support, and I don't know, I think I just thought this is where I'm supposed to be, so that's where I was.
You've been acting for a long time now. Does it still feel to you like you were right, this always was the place to be?
Oh, yeah. I don't doubt my path at all. After high school, I went to an amazing theater training at University of Evansville that you mentioned in my bio. And, you know, I wrote a blog about this on my Substack called The Actor Path, because even if my career hasn't been what I thought it would be, and even though the work is sporadic just by nature, the actor path gave me everything I am. It gave me my friendships. It gave me, you know, New York City. It gave me, it catapulted me into my adult life that has gotten more complex in terms of vocation and work. But I will always be an actor. In fact, when I was in my 20s, when I decided to become an interfaith minister at the time, and I had started writing, and I decided, oh, this acting thing is too hard. And I actually went to my agents in New York, and I sat down and I said, I think I was 26, 27, and I said, I'm done with this. I'm going to be an interfaith minister and a writer. I'm done with this acting thing. And she just looked at me with a little smirk, and she said, okay. Because she knew it was not possible. And sure enough, the very next week, I got some Law and Order or something. Anyway, and I had to join Screen Actors Guild. It's like, so it didn't work. So I also started to realize I can't not be an actor. That was the permission I gave myself in my 20s as I discovered I had more than one vocation. I realized I couldn't not be an actor, because that's like me saying I'm not a woman, I'm not American, you know, it's like part of who I am. And so I couldn't deny that. So I just said, okay, I'll just do it my way. I'll be an actor and this.
You mentioned the interfaith ministry, so I wonder if this is a good segue into exploring what is that other calling? And you've described yourself as a secular chaplain. What do you mean when you call yourself secular, and what do you mean when you call yourself chaplain?
Okay, so I definitely became a spiritual seeker big time when I was in my 20s. And I just couldn't get enough. I was just hungry. I wanted those conversations about mysticism and the path of the individual and all these things. I was just so curious. And I knew I was a seeker. I knew I had no dogma. I had no interest in dogma. I knew I wouldn't necessarily find a home in any particular belief system. And so when I found out about this interfaith ministry training program for 2 years, and I found out that it was part-time, it wasn't like getting your Master's of Divinity, I could still be auditioning, I could still be working as an actor and do these classes. I thought, oh, that's good, that's good. And so after 2 years, I got ordained, and I started officiating weddings. I've officiated, I don't know, 50 weddings over the years, memorial services, different rituals, different things. And that all felt great because it was like putting on little plays. Like it felt like I knew how to do this, you know? But what started to happen that I noticed was that people started coming to me, and it was really the sweet spot of the one-on-one conversations where I was finding the work the most meaningful for me. And I was having people say, over and over, you're the only person I feel safe having these kinds of conversations with. And so I started to realize that, I don't know, the way I was listening, holding space, whatever, made people feel particularly safe or felt seen and heard. And so many years later, when I was living in Los Angeles at the time, I went through a 2-year training in spiritual direction, which is an ancient listening practice. And I really felt at home in that. And I definitely felt more at home in that than interfaith ministry in terms of calling myself that. So I am a spiritual director. That's my training. But then I did a community crisis chaplaincy training a few years ago, and I was reading wonderful books about chaplaincy. And that felt more like it named who I am and what I am in the world to people. They define chaplaincy as a ministry of presence, you know? And you learn presence in acting, as acting, right? You learn about being present and what it means to inhabit this space fully. Mind, heart, soul, all of it, body, everything. So I decided I'm going to take that word on. And then I decided on secular because I work with atheists. I work with agnostics. I work with people who are having radically changing belief systems in our work together. And so the secular is a way of saying, hey, this is a safe zone. I have no agenda here. I have no agenda. And also I realize so many people today, certainly in my generation, almost are allergic to spiritual and religious language, even to words like spirituality. I have friends who bristle at the word prayer, who bristle at the word minister, you know? And so I thought, okay, how can I be the most welcoming, the most spacious in my offering of presence? And it was secular chaplain. And it's interesting, I am a spiritual director for many different people, but specifically for a full-time chaplain who has a Master's of Divinity in the whole nine yards. And after one of our sessions, I said, I have to ask you a personal question. And I said, is it okay with, I felt like I needed her permission or something. Is it okay with you if I use the term chaplain? Does that offend you because you have gone about it in such a more traditional way than I have? In other words, you have earned this title and this credential in all these different ways. Is it okay with you if I use that word chaplain? And she just said, duh. Yeah, of course. She said, when people say, what's a spiritual director? She said, I just call you my personal chaplain. And I said, okay, great. And so that helped me to settle into it.
You'd mentioned a Catholic upbringing, and I wonder what was the journey from being raised, as it were, in that environment to one where perhaps you are much more open to all faiths and no faiths?
Well, again, I actually wrote a blog about this recently. It's called Holy Contradiction. Again, this permission in myself to hold contradiction has been continues to benefit me. Not only, not just contradiction, but this word and, right? The holy and. So I can say, I'm an actor and this and this. It's the same thing with, I was raised Catholic, and so I can, oh wow, what I got from my Catholic upbringing. I got this introduction to ritual. I got a spiritual home. I got these incredible role models like Dorothy Day and Daniel Berrigan and Thomas Merton and these mystics, just amazing, amazing, amazing. And it's the path of my ancestors. And you know, it was my first spiritual home. And I can be really mad about the Catholic Church and be like, I don't subscribe to the dogma. I identify as a lesbian. I identify as pro-choice. I'm an ordained female. I obviously can have a lot of issues with Rome and the Catholic Church. I'm big enough to hold it all. And I apply that to my spirituality as well, right? I go home to Louisville. I go to church for Christmas, on Christmas Day. I love that particular church that I go to in Louisville. I love it. It's an important community for me. And I don't believe, quote, in Catholic dogma. But ritual, tradition, different sacred texts, walks in nature, all of it can be used to connect me to the all, right? To connect me to my bigger self, to help me feel like I am communing with the sacred. And going to church a couple times a year in my home parish is a way to do that, in addition to all these other ways, including dinner with friends, going on walks in New York City. Matthew Fox, who's a theologian I love very much, he says prayer is a radical response to life, you know? So it's just like, wow, what engages you? What engages your heart? What engages and makes you feel alive on the planet? That's holy in itself.
That's a big question. What makes you feel holy, sacred, alive on this planet? Which makes me then wonder, why do people come to you to seek your spiritual companionship? You've already mentioned that someone who is a more mainstream ordained chaplain describes you as their personal chaplain. So I'm curious, who are, why are the people that you serve coming to you?
I don't know. I guess, you know, part of being on a spiritual path is honoring the mystery, right? And so it's sort of trusting who comes our way is meant to come our way. I don't know. You know, when I first meet with somebody, you know, we usually just have a conversation to see if we're a good fit. That's how I word it, right? All I can say is the way that I listen helps people. I have no idea why. I don't understand it. It just does. And so I'm going to keep doing it. And the people who come to me, I'm telling you, such diversity of age, such diversity of life experience. And I so enjoy this work. It doesn't even feel like work. I've never felt drained after a session. In fact, it's very life-giving for me. One of my fascinations since childhood, I think I mentioned I had that little book about Martin Luther King when I was a kid. And I had a book of saints and all that stuff too. And I had a book about Amelia Earhart. I loved biographies. I still love biographies. I am fascinated by the journey of the individual, the unique journey and unfolding path of an individual. And if I can hold space for that and honor someone's individuality without judgment and, you know, witnessing them through the eyes of love, if that's my work for that hour, whoa, what an honor. I love it. It's wonderful.
And so you recognize that you are a good listener. You're someone that can hold a space in which other people can respond in an open, authentic, vulnerable, intimate way. But how do you know that is a gift that is particularly special?
Well, One of the reasons I knew Still Point, which is where I did my spiritual direction training, was good for me, was the right place for me. I'm actually on the staff now as a mentor for the first year students, is that they call it an art form. They say the art of spiritual direction. And I know what that is, right? And the same with being an actor and a writer, I'm also those things. So I'm I'm a listening artist, I'm an acting artist, and I'm a writing artist, right? So when you go to a training of any kind, you bring the gift with you. They don't give you the gift. You bring the gift with you, and then they help to craft it, right? They give you an experience. They give you wisdom and knowledge and tangible, practical experience to practice the gift. And to be an artist in the world means I'm always learning how to do it better. I'm always curious about how to change and how to expand. You know, you can't ever say I'm a perfect actor, I'm a perfect writer, I'm a perfect, you know, listener. That it's like not even in that realm of things. So it requires curiosity. It requires openness. It requires discipline. It requires going to supervision and being like, ooh, I was not a good listener in that moment, right? Ooh, I really lost my concentration in that moment. What's going on there? It requires self-awareness. It requires a desire to always be a student, you know? And so in terms of knowing I have a gift, well, isn't that witness back to you, right? So it's understanding that my interior experience is, oh, this feels very natural. This comes naturally to me, acting, writing, and listening. And it's witnessed back to me in my life experiences and people saying, I see this in you. But yeah, confidence, it's sort of like the public speaking thing or the acting thing. If you're sitting and watching a play and you're watching an actor up there and she's not confident and she doesn't really know what she's doing and she's shaking and nervous and da-da-da-da, well, you're going to get nervous and stuff like that, right? So it does require some sort of confidence, like driving, right? Like, I got this. And so when people are coming to me, yeah, I have to have some confidence to say, I got this. I gotcha. I'm holding space for you. I know how to do it.
I read your assertion that listening requires an act of surrender, which to me speaks to aspects and attributes around courage and vulnerability. And that's just in you, the listener, let alone someone who you are inviting into that space. And I just wonder if you might unpack a little bit more, as it were, the toll that it can take to be an active listener.
It does require surrender in the same way that performance requires surrender. There's a giving over and a deep trust. Oh, it requires so much trust, right? And there's a quote I love. I actually have it on my computer because I wanted to read it. In terms of the toll it takes. More than the toll it takes, I would say the responsibility of it. The responsibility to be able to surrender. It requires me knowing how to silence and quiet my own mind so that I am truly just able to hold space with non-judgment, without an agenda, without distraction. And there's this great quote by William Butler Yeats that I'd love to share that just touches me very much. And it says, we can make our minds so like still water that beings gather about us that they may see their own images and so live for a moment with a clearer, perhaps even with a fiercer life because of our quiet. It's a good one, isn't it?
One of the many things I find interesting about that particular quote is this idea of living a fiercer life because of someone else's stillness in that place. So I wanted to ask you then, you've discerned some of these personal attributes, these elements of this calling that you callings that you possess, but being that, as it were, still water, allowing others to live fierce lives. What observations or lessons have you learned about what it is that society writ large, people, the mass of people writ large, what is that yearning that you're observing in the broader world? What is holding back those fierce lives?
If I were to describe spiritual direction in secular terms, which I often do, I would call myself an inner awareness coach. I would say this desire to know oneself, to be fully actualized, to be fully self-expressed and witnessed in this world as the unique, loving being that each of us is. Oh, that desire is strong. When someone's really listening to you, right, you listen to yourself also. And so sometimes it's just an opportunity for someone to listen to themselves, to really listen, to hear themselves, and to get to know themselves more, to understand who is this being that I am. And my hope, my intention, if I had one intention in my work, it's to help people grow in their self-love. I feel like if the mind in each of us was a kinder place to be, the world would be a kinder place to be. Breaks my heart when I think about how hard people are on themselves with their internal dialogue and their internal criticism of self, and can be so incredibly harsh. And so surely that is a yearning that each of us has, right? To feel loved and welcomed in this world. And that begins within oneself. And if I can help with that, wonderful. I think people want to feel whole. People want to feel whole in a culture, in a society that doesn't allow us to feel whole or doesn't encourage our wholeness.
You mentioned earlier the community crisis chaplain work that you were trained in as part of a New York task force. And I wonder if you could expand on that, because it seems as if we've been talking a little bit about the individual self and how you help other individuals with their own journey, as it were, into that spiritual examination. But this community crisis chaplain sounds a little more holistic in some ways, but probably no less tangible. So would you share a little more about that?
I actually did it mainly just for the training. I'm on the task force. I haven't practiced it a lot. It's basically kind of an on-call, you know. I wanted to do the training. I mean, I had to get trained in CPR and all these things. And I wanted the training so that I could better understand certain crises that can come up in public spaces. Like mental health emergencies, things like that. And so the training was great. Because again, like I said, I'm always going to be a student. And if this is a training that says it speaks to me, I'm going to say yes to it. I'm going to do it. In the same way that, like, when I first started taking classes in interfaith ministry, I had no idea where it would lead, right? Same with spiritual direction. I didn't know where it was going to go. It was just this, I'm trusting my path here. I'm just going to say yes to it because it feels like the right thing to do. And so I can see that maybe in my future I will have more, certainly in the entertainment community, opportunities to serve as a secular chaplain in ways that aren't just for the individual. And so if I can continue to do training in that, expand what that is, I'm going to do it.
You suggested that your own journey has itself been an organic one, intuitively led. And yet, nonetheless, we also live in a society that expects certain rubber stamps and letters and acronyms and accreditations and so on and so forth. You've talked about going through various steps of ministry and spiritual direction, this kind of thing. Could you just explain a little bit more about how you reached this point? And perhaps even if you would do things differently, if if you sort of started over?
Well, if I wasn't in the entertainment industry, if I wasn't an actor, and again, like I said, I am an actor, I can't not be an actor, but if that wasn't my path, I think I probably would have gone to like Union Theological Seminary or something in New York City. I think I would have happily been a pastor at a Unitarian church, you know, certainly social justice oriented in that work as well. I came to understand, and again, give myself permission, okay, this part of my path isn't going to be conventional, the accreditation, as you say. But at the same time, the people who are coming to me for guidance of any kind, or certainly with a yearn for spiritual companionship, they aren't looking for the conventional. If they want the conventional, they can go elsewhere, right? I was in my first year of training as an interfaith minister 20 years ago, okay? And since then, I have not stopped going to seminars, webinars, trainings, reading about spirituality, reading about the path of the individual, reading about all sorts of things, getting training, getting classes. And so, yes, I am not affiliated with academia in that regard. But I felt like, okay, after 20 years of this, I think I can, you know, give myself a diploma of some kind, you know. It's cool. I got it. It's okay, you know. I would never dare to do this work or call myself a secular chaplain or even offer these services if I had just gone to some, like, weekend retreat or something and, like, you know. No. This is a lifetime devotion. So, but yeah, I'm not an academic. I'm not an academic person. I'm an intellectual, but I'm not an academic.
You alluded to this just a little bit earlier, and I'm curious about these formative experiences in your life. You attended what you've described as a life-altering workshop, and this was maybe a decade or so ago, but it's a life-altering workshop for women that you took that led you to focus on exploring the shadow self. And I know that having since taken that workshop, you have led a workshop like that. So I'm curious, what was life-altering about this workshop? What was it, and what was life-altering?
So this workshop was created by three women in the 90s who are all mentors to me in different capacities. Joan McIntosh, Leslie Avazian, and Olympia Dukakis. And I had taken an acting class from Olympia, and of course she was an incredible actor. And she wrote her memoir, I read her memoir, and I wrote her a letter, like actually typed it and put it in the mail. Because in her memoir she had talked about this exploring these matriarchal cultures and these old myths and creating, like, you know, workshops around them. And I was so curious. And so I wrote her a letter and I said, I'm curious about this too. I just got ordained as an interfaith minister and I did a play and I just did this play and blah, blah, blah. And surprisingly enough, she wrote me back and she said, let's meet for coffee. So we meet for coffee. And I was just so curious about her own journey as an actor and an artist and what moved her in terms of learning about matriarchal culture and this kind of history. And that she said, you know, had been covered with silence for centuries. And that was very moving to me. And so she told me about this workshop she led, and they didn't do it very often. And so she said, I'll just put you on the mailing list or tell you my assistant to put you on the mailing list. I forgot about it. 2 years later, I get this invitation, and I was the first person to sign up. And it was life-altering. This was in the fall of 2009. It was life-altering because I made incredible friends in that room. It was life-altering because I had never investigated the shadow side in such a public way, and there's only 20 of us in the room, but the permission to hold contradiction that I mentioned, that was taught, that language was taught to me in that room. And, you know, they say that that there was this sort of almost celebration of our shadow side, an invitation to bring it forward, to explore it, to have it be witnessed. The workshop is centered around the myth of Inanna and her journey into the underworld, where she meets her sister, Ereshkigal, who lives in the underworld. And so in the workshop, it's called the Inanna Workshop. Each woman sort of inhabits the archetype of Inanna and the archetype of Ereshkigal. So who are you in the outer world? How do you prevail in this outer world? And what is the cost of that? What parts of you are pushed under in exile, you know? And even when I was so young, but even when I was in this room with Olympia and Joan was teaching it as well, I remember thinking, I was like one of the youngest people in the room. And I remember thinking, I want to lead this someday. And sure enough, so we did it with her a couple years go by. And anyway, just serendipitously, it got passed on to me and my friend Desiree. Olympia passed the torch on to us. And I did get to lead the workshop with Olympia once, which was amazing. And she, died 3 years ago in May. But she was a mentor to me until she died. And so it's incredible that this legacy was passed on to Desiree and myself, and it continues to enrich me and empower me, that work and that myth. And I haven't done it since the pandemic, but we're hoping to do it in Los Angeles this year.
I'm struck by that word, contradictions. And we've talked a little bit about how you have these three vocations. You are a writing artist, you're an acting artist, and you're also a listening spiritual artist as well. And some of these things clearly overlap, as you've mentioned. I'm also wondering about some of the potential contradictions. Is there, for example, a contradiction between being an actor that assumes the role of someone else, that is performing to a world, as opposed to someone who is reaching deeply inwards to something more real or concrete or authentic that is a singular you? So I'm just wondering, are these two things in tension or are they aligned?
Sometimes they are in tension. They do have tension. I remember I was doing a play in Seattle, and I remember right before going on stage crying, because I remember thinking, this character is so pathetic and weak, and I don't know. And they always say, don't judge your character. I guess I was feeling the moment. I was judging her in that moment. But I was just saying, oh my God, this scene is so hard. And I want to go and talk to the audience and say my own thoughts. I don't want to say the playwright's words. And I just sort of had this moment of saying, of feeling sort of, I felt a little oppressed by the circumstance of having to do this performance for the 50th time. And everything. So that can come up sometimes, sure. And also, sometimes, especially exploring material that feels very far away from me in terms of my own personal life, that can be a little exhausting because I do work so hard, and I have for my whole life, to be the most authentic person I can be. And I help others be their most authentic self. So authenticity is so, sometimes it is bizarre to be like, okay, I'm going to put that authentic self on hold, and I'm just going to go inhabit this other, I'm going to go play pretend, basically. And sometimes there is a tension where it's like, I don't want to play pretend. I've earned this authenticity, you know. But then again, part of that surrender, when acting is joyous, it is, oh, I am recognizing this aspect of the human self that I have explored in me, and I'm going to share it with this character. And it's so delicious and so exciting and so satisfying to sort of share my own awareness with as my own human self as I animate these words on a page, you know, that can be satisfying too. But yeah, sometimes the tension is there for sure.
We talked a little bit about how much giving there is, whether we've used language like surrender, that beautiful quote that you shared from Yeats about being the still water so others can live fiercely. But I did also reference earlier that, like, the toll that all of that giving can take. So I'm curious how you nurture while you're busy ministering to other people's spiritual needs, how you in turn ensure that you are nurturing and sustaining your own spiritual growth.
Well, part of my self-journey, especially being raised Catholic and female, is really sort of untying this notion that to be a giver, there must be sacrifice, right? That was taught to me as a Catholic, right? That sacrifice is so great. Oh my gosh, you should just be, you know, like the whole martyr thing. And so I feel like I'm still sort of untangling that for myself, untying those two. My own self-care, growing an understanding of what my own self-care is, which does include investigating my own shadow, which does include, obviously, my own physical health and spiritual health and having time to be quiet and reflective and sleep, loving sleep, and time with friends and understanding how I can feel nourished, right? So that I'm giving from my overflow. I'm not giving from my depletion. And that is that's something that, you know, I've had to learn. Each individual has to understand what nourishment is required to do their work in the world. But if I'm feeling really drained, like I said, I don't feel drained in this work. If I am feeling drained, then that's like a, ooh, pay attention to that. Why are you feeling drained? Maybe this is not somebody I should be working with, right? So self-care is where it's at.
How do you know if someone is a fit for you being their spiritual companion?
Yeah. Or if they're not a good fit. I would say, first of all, intuition. If somebody's not a fit for me, I'm just going to know. And I would say how I know they are a good fit is if they just show up. If they're honest communicators, if they, if it's, yes, they have to put a lot of trust in me, but I have to put a trust in them also, right? That they're going to show up, that they're going to be honest with me, that they genuinely want to explore their interior and that they're willing to do that, that they're not looking for me to save them or they're not looking to depend on me in any way. You know, I'm like, I think of it sort of like, you know, they're going into the wilderness of their soul. And I'm here like, I got a flashlight. I got a map that's, you know, might be useful, but you got to do it yourself, you know?
So many of us are trying to make meaning, to feel complete, whole. And I think that applies also to you. And I wonder if you feel as if you are making meaning out of your life, the things you do, the way you show up, if you feel as if you are living into something that is both meaningful and purposeful for you.
I like to think that I am. You know, when I was only 23, I was so young, and I had a friend say, I just met somebody who, she's an actor, but she's also a life coach. And I said, what's a life coach? I'd never heard that term before. And he said, well, I don't know, but for some reason, out of everyone I know, I think you should meet with her. That was a good intuition on his part. And I met with this woman, and she had me write out a little mission statement for myself. And I was so young. But right then, it made sense to me, right, that, oh, my life can have a mission or a vision or a purpose that doesn't have to fit into anything that's on a resume. It doesn't have to fit into a job title. It's just about how I am in the world, how I'm being in the world, how I am, you know, that may my presence uplift someone today, even if it's just going to the CVS, you know? There's so much that goes on in this world that we have no idea about, right? There's so much power that we have to influence the most minuscule little things that we have no idea about. And so all I can do is trust my path, teach others how to trust their own paths, and model, perhaps, the unconventional path. Maybe that's what I'm here to do. I don't know. Maybe I'm here to model what it is to have an unconventional relationship with work and vocation, you know, because we all need way showers sometimes, right?
I really appreciate you showing us the way. I want to ask one last thing. And this is a question, but I'll just say train enthusiast.
Oh, I'm a train enthusiast. It's true. Did I describe myself as a train enthusiast? My blog, by the way, is called The Morton Train. It's on Substack. I love trains. I don't know why. We used to take the train from, I guess it was Indianapolis. We had to drive up to Indianapolis and then take the train all the way to North Dakota to visit my grandmother when I was a kid. So I love taking the train. And my other grandmother gave me a great appreciation for public transportation. We would take the bus around Louisville. And so when I moved to New York City, I didn't have my own car. You don't have a car, you know? And so I would take subways and everything. And then I would love to take the train. I took the train, you know, they have the Metro North, and the whole train culture in the New England is just amazing to me. I love it. And I spent a semester in England, and there's trains there. And I love old train stations. I just love trains. And when I was 27, right before I started studying interfaith ministry, actually, I took a cross-country Amtrak trip by myself. I love trains. What can I say? I just love them. And I wish the United States funded more high-speed rail. That's good. I'm just going to plug that right now.
My guest today has been actor, writer, and secular chaplain, Elizabeth Morton. Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Stuart. It's been fun. Really nice talking to you.
Lives is brought to you on KIOS Omaha Public Radio and is produced by Courtney Bierman. The music you hear playing in and playing out is performed by Andrew Bailey. Podcasts of today's show and others can be found at livesradioshow.com or where you get your podcasts. Subscribe today and please leave a review. I'm your host, Stuart Chittenden. Join me next week as we delve further into the practical and profound possibilities of living well. Thanks for listening.